No, that's a brilliant question. And what I've come to realize is that there's no set playbook, right, for running and building a fund, right? What we've done well, I believe, is
I think this gets missed when you build something, just how important it is to have your back end strong. And I think this is one of the things of, coming from a business family, right? With something that keeps getting reiterated. What is the value of 1 rupee to every Indian? We ask ourselves this very often, by the way. What does that mean? Right? It's very different in a, city like Delhi to possibly somewhere, 3 hours out. I think people do spend a disproportionate amount on aesthetics, right? This is very interesting, but on beauty, right? I think there's going to be a disproportionate amount on travel. I think this generation, especially the younger ones that are coming into sort of the workforce, will spend a lot of money on travel. Could be domestic, could be. And I think, and I expand that. I say travel and experiences. And so that's why it has to be affordable and aspirational. And I think because of social media, the aspirational part is key, because if you're spending money, you want other people to know about it. And I think we all fit in that category, right?
Yeah.
And I think that's the mindset shift that may not have been.
Welcome to the Indian Silicon Valley podcast. I'm your host, Jibraj, and today I have with me two very interesting individuals. Join me in welcoming the co-founders and managing partners of Riverwalk Holdings, an early-stage micro VC fund, which has a fund size of $25 million. Join me in welcoming Jay Sumer Singh and Sapir Singh Thakral. Thank you so much for joining, guys. Very, very excited to be hosting you.
It's great to be here. It's a pleasure.
Awesome. What distinctly stands out is I think I met Jay almost like 2.5, 3 years back for an event. And I think since then I've seen, the firm do so well and it's grown so much. And I interacted with Sapir a couple of weeks back for the first time, and I was blown away by the humility, by the interesting insights on business. And I want to combine both of those bits as we understand more about Riverwalk, more about how to establish an early stage fund, and also like these insights, right? But before we dive into all of that, it'll be very interesting to just hear a quick insight to, early careers, early inspiration when it comes to what you've been doing till now. You, of course, had this, family business that you were built on top of now and have been leading new initiatives. You come from a finance background and you've now been doing tech investing for a while. It'll be great to hear something about that, and then we can go into specific bits. Yes.
Yeah, I'm happy to go
sure.
First. Well, thank you for being here. I think when Jay and I discussed this, we don't do this very often, but you've built such an exciting community of people and thought leadership, and we're both very honored to be here. I think coming from a family business that was already heavily focused on doing business in India, when I moved in 2013 into the business and started focusing on India, it also coincided with us starting our angel investing journey, which of course now has grown into a lot more than that. And at the time, it felt like a no-brainer. The ecosystem was a lot smaller than, some names, then were all used to sit in one room. You could walk into a room, you'd see Rajanandan, Uncle Sanjeev Vikchandani, and the likes. It was maybe a 100, 200 people ecosystem at the most, and you've seen how that's grown. I think for us, the reason we put faith in the ecosystem was that from a family business perspective, growth is always valued, but new initiatives, as you mentioned, are very hard to find. I think three factors really made us excited on why it felt like technology investing was the right thing to do in 2013. And I think a big part of it was the initiatives that were being led by the Indian government. As Prime Minister Modi, very early in his years as leader, put the whole digital infrastructure right in front. So that was very nice for us. That was one very big building block. Two was the obvious demographics, and the Indian entrepreneurs are among, or if not the best in the world, along with the tech talent and the rising sort of abilities. And I think third, for us as a family, we've always been able to sit down and have long-term views on investments. And I think one thing that's very clear a decade later is that a big part of the successful firms that have made it as investors are the ones who've been able to stick it out with entrepreneurs, right? Investing sometimes is not always an upwards journey. It's sometimes not as linear as it should be, but it's always very rewarding. I think it's, my perspective, India will continue to be where we want to play. Riverwalk Holdings is proof of not just the family's commitment, but Jay's and my commitment of how we want to do this, how we hopefully be part of the story that keeps growing.
Awesome. Jay.
Yeah, so, I've been born and brought up in Delhi, and did my schooling here and college from here as well. Like most people talk about stumbling into venture capital. You know, I took the opposite route. This was very carefully planned and very carefully calibrated. So, I mean, very early in my college life, I figured out that, you know, there are many ways to make money, but only one way to sort of compound it, right? Which is learning how to invest it. So, you know, that with that, I kickstarted my journey, started sort of reading the investment greats, right? Warren Buffett, Charlie Munger's of the world. And one thing led to another. I enrolled for the CFA program. Post-college, joined EY in their transaction advisory practice. So I was part of the valuations desk there. We were essentially evaluating more mature companies, mostly for, you know, big ticket M&As, both for the buy side and sell side. So did almost just that for almost 3.5-4 years. And then, you know, like every consultant went through the trough of disillusionment wherein, you know, I realized, yaar, sari mehnat to khud hi kar rahe hain, right? But client decision le raha hai ki kya karna hai ki nahi karna. While I was spending time at EY, I completed my CFA and then essentially wanted and actually was itching to put, you know, the theory to practical use. Right. So, you know, started investing mostly in the public markets and yeah, built a decent sort of, you know, exposure there and lots of mistakes, lots of learnings. Did a couple of early stage investments as well. And met Satveer through the network. So yeah, it's been 5 years now in the VC space, and time really flies if you're loving what you do. So yeah,
no, for sure. I think that's super exciting to hear. What might be helpful to understand is now that you know you met maybe let's say 5-6 years back, how did that you know compound into becoming the partnership that it has? What was the genesis of it? What really struck by? Yeah. If you could maybe elaborate on that.
I think we were the last two standing. that definitely helped. So by elimination, we were the only two ones that were standing. And no, but on a serious note, I think we complement each other in many aspects, which is what you know should be there in a great sort of co-founding team, right? So the ability to sort of balance both aspects and you know to cover each other's blind spots. While having the long-term mindset and you know ethically and morally being aligned, right, on sort of your core value systems, I think that was something that played a big role. This happened organically, right? It wasn't a sort of a deep conversation that we need to have over coffee or other preferential beverages, but it happened fairly organically, I'd say. Yeah.
So what was that first avatar like? So now that you've decided that, okay, we're going to do this together, you co-found this eventual micro VC fund, it's a bit sizable, you know, size right now. Right. Like, what is the first genesis of the idea look like? And what does it look like now? Now that, you know, it's 5 years in, if you talk about that.
Yeah, so it's weird, you want
to... Yeah, I think there was a lot of clarity early on, like Jay said. I think the meeting of the minds, and I think culturally we're very similar. You know, we're actually very close friends more than anything else, I think. And the strategy that's played out was based on the long-term faith in what this was meant to be, right? I think Jay and I are both very clear. We want to be investors. We want to generally be hands-off investors, right? We believe we know how to run Riverwalk. Founders know how to run their businesses. Where that aligns has to be clear. And I think the strategy that Riverwalk now follows was always one that we were consciously working towards. We always wanted to be an institution, right? Even when we were a family office, we were very clear that this had to be something that would scale and definitely should scale way past Jay and I. At one point, we should be irrelevant to this maybe 100 years from now. Riverwalk should be around. I think that's very clear. It was always very clear to what we did, right? When you read the greats, when you think about how they do, it's not really about them. It's about the institution. I think in terms of where we 5 years ago were, we believed in India. That time, maybe we didn't have the kind of successes or the exits that we now have. So that proved itself, right? There was money to be made. Let's be real. This is also a lot of it is about what you can do financially, right? So we've proven there's money to be made. We've made some money. A lot of people have made money. I think the second part is the quality of Indian entrepreneurs keeps getting better, right? I think we've seen an incredible amount of people who would never have built businesses 10 years ago, right? Like yourself, I don't think if you were born and grown up in the decade of maybe if you went to school in the early 2000s, or you went to college mid 2000s, I don't think you'd be building your own business. I think at that time, the mindset was find something stable,
you know, get a great job, of course, and maybe not be as you know, entrepreneurial as people are. And I think, so when you look at the strategy, it was built based on what we knew. Riverwalk was built around us investing in who we knew and with who we know. So that still holds, right? We very rarely will invest in someone unless we've actually spent time with them, right? And that means, it could be, of course, for the business, which means, of course, multiple conversations around where this is going, you know, spending time, but also, I would say, to a large degree, even socially. I think Jay and I both have deep relationships with founders we invest in. I think you know this firsthand also, right? And a lot of that involves non-work time, because ultimately, I think this gets forgotten sometimes, but this is a people's business, right? And it's people before anything else, right? So I think for us, if you look back at why Riverwalk, why now? And now it's already been, you know, when I was year two of Riverwalk. It's because we knew that this had to be. I think the thing that we did very well, and I really recommend anyone listening, is we didn't rush this. This has taken the time it should. We went from family office, double down on our best companies. I mean, you know the journey. And then for those who don't, we, you know, obviously made 100 investments, kept sort of doubling down on our best. That became, you know, maybe 20 of the companies and now hold a large amount of the value of the portfolio. And then decided, okay, now let's build Riverwalk. Let's do this correctly. And even if you look at Riverwalk, the first few founders that we actually invested in and partnered with, ones that we already knew, and in some cases even had worked with. And so the comfort was people you know, work with who you know, work ideally with people you love, and especially, you know, in uncertain times. So I think that continues to be the strategy. This is a people's business, and we know that.
Awesome. I think I love the emphasis on people, and I think it shows even in private conversations with all of you, the part of the team. It shows that you want to over-index on how you treat people, what is the conduct with them, and how important you make them feel. And that's just like phenomenal. I want to come back to that, but you know, talking about the fund in and of itself, it seems like a steeper challenge than you made it sound, right? So I'd love to understand and double click on how to go about establishing like an early stage fund in the country, because it also looks like in the years that Riverwalk has gotten established, the VC ecosystem has matured a bunch. Capital is available in abundant. There are multiple firms coming up. Multiple firms with great portfolios doubling down in the early stages, right? So there's no clear distinction as to, okay, this stage will be dominated by these set of funds, and this stage will be specific to these set of funds. When the competition, for the lack of a better word, is such when it comes to capital providers, how do you distinctly, you know, carve out your own niche, your own brand? Indexing on people is of course one, but what are other things that, you know, you think Riverwalk has gotten right when it comes to this?
Yeah, no, that's a brilliant question. And, you know, what I've come to realize is that there's no set playbook, right, for running and building a fund, right? What we've done well, I believe, is trying to play to our strengths, right? And then trying to basically minimize and mitigate whatever the weaknesses are, right? A lot of people think that, funds, or sort of managing a fund is just sort of about the investing bit, right? But there's so much more, right? And so essentially, if you see, right, having the right team is critical, right? Not just your core team, but even the consultants who you wish to sort of onboard, right? Because these are the people who are basically going to, you know, ensure that whatever you have today is a platform, right, which you can sort of leverage to scale further, right? So I think that's equally important, and you know, we can sort of cover this in detail as well, however you want to do.
Sure. So let's talk about the team further, right? I mean, Sahil is also the reason that we're all here. So yeah. Sahil, of course, is a close friend. You all cherish. There are other people in the team, but you've always maintained a very frugal setup, right?
Yes.
It's not like a army of 50, 20 people doing this. It's a very small sort of group of people, yet working like very in-depth with everything. Talk about how do you hire, how do you maintain this culture where you make like sort of a lucrative setting for everyone involved, align incentives and help them do their best work. What is that like in a fund? Because you're, you know, in a business where you look at other entrepreneurs and that energy is very contagious.
Correct.
So how do you, you know, transfer that into the team itself? What is that like?
Yeah, I think we've kept the team small because of my personal disdain of having a large group and having to do multiple one-on-ones.
Yeah.
But keeping that aside, I think, you know, if you sort of look at the median age of the team, it's still going to be sort of below 30, under 30, right, across everyone. And I think that energy is something that, you know, we're trying to harness, right, and make sure that sort of is spread across everything that we do. But from a culture standpoint, right, it's just something that as an individual, right, if you're a young professional, what would you like in your workplace, right? And we've just tried to sort of, put that in place, right, across everything that we do. So again, it's a people business, right, across all fronts, right, even internally. And both Satveer and I have been very conscious on sort of how, we've sort of built the team, right, and how we've basically handpicked each individual. Right, we're extremely long-term thinkers, so everyone on the fund has ownership, right? And you would know this, they both work and act like owners, right? And not as employees who are basically, looking to sort of fill a sort of a line item in their CV and then move on to the next thing. So I think that's something that's inculcated, and all of us share this camaraderie, and it's just a very fun place to sort of work. Right, and very fulfilling as well.
Yeah, I know. I often mention to Sahil that it seems just such a wholesome place to be at. But I'd be interested to know, what does this look like in practice, right? Any anecdotal stories where this tactically comes to use, just so that we have more reference points?
Yeah, so I'm not sure how we've sort of, we'd put this to use tactically. Mm-hmm. But it's not like, the journey was super smooth, right? Right. We've had to sort of, really figure out if the team that we've put together, is working working well, right, or not, right? So it's actually trial and error. And in fact, building a business in the country, I think hiring is the toughest thing,
yes,
to do, right? And we've obviously indexed on people so much,
yes,
right, that it just becomes super, super difficult.
Fair enough. No, super interesting.
And I think one thing I wanted to add, I think we've been very clean. Jay referenced this, right? There's the core team. There's then the ancillary support system. And I think in a separate comment, he mentioned consultants. We've been very clear that no matter the size of fund or, whatever the ability of the fund itself would be, we've always, even if that meant putting our own money, mm-hmm, we've always made sure that we've had the best consultants. And I think this is so critical in starting off something, especially. And so much of what we don't focus on is handled by the best. Law firms, accountants, our CFO, which is, all of these are so critical functions that you don't realize it's wrong until it's really wrong, right? And we have complete comfort that the core team then just focuses on what we do best. And I think this gets missed when you build something, just how important it is to have your back end strong. And I think this is one of the things of, coming from a business family, right, with something that keeps getting reiterated. I think even for us at group level, it's just important to have a very steady, like a steady foundation. So we focus on that greatly, yeah, right? So the team then, and our whole team, right? I think we all focus on what we do, what we, yeah, love, but we make sure what we don't know as well is being handled by the best. So I think, there's something that really needs to be remembered by anyone building a business, a fund. It's critical, really.
Crucial. I don't think I was trying to recall if I've heard support functions being mentioned the way you have, but I don't think I have. But goes to show that it's very crucial to emphasize on it.
And it's interesting you say support functions, right? Because if you look at it, if those functions fail, you would fall harder,
exactly,
than if Jay and I wanted a walk. If our back end function failed,
yeah,
we would be, there would be no, and I think that gets missed. So.
Very, very glad that you mentioned it. I think good thing to emphasize on. I'm trying to now also understand how, the first couple of companies perhaps took shape. So now we've understood the fund structure,
yeah,
the ideology, the DNA. If you had to talk about some of the initial investments, right? Because, you graduate from an angel investing journey to a family office to a fund. What was that like? If you could maybe highlight some of the early wins, what did that look like? If there were some of the deals initially that you couldn't be a part of, what is the reason for that? If we could strategically mention those bits.
Yeah. I think early wins are critical, right? Because if you don't have those, after a while, you start sort of doubting why you're doing this. I think it as it would anyway. I think one of the things about this business is that your misses comes before your hits, right? Just because of the time it takes for you to know something successful versus, right, and it's very important to not see it as a loss, right? The reason I say miss is because even our startups that haven't performed financially well for us was not for a lack of effort, either the founding team or the work done, right? Sometimes things just don't work. And I think we always have to remember that when one does well, and that very often may mean five did not, right, in this business.
But it's not fair to say that this is why this worked and these were not. You know, I mean, very often we, you know, I mean, maybe we over-index on people, but I think we definitely also, as people, I think we sometimes don't realize the importance of timing, of luck, of you know, there's a lot of things that go. I think if you pick, you know, if you look at a race, right, all the runners are actually really fast, right? To be honest, right, they're already the world's best. So I think we that's very important. I think so for us, the journey of Angel, you know, larger checks, doubling down, was built even when startups didn't perform well financially. The conviction we saw in which they were built, being built with, gave us the conviction to keep doing this. And the reason I mention is we made 100 investments. All 100 were critical in shaping our thinking, yeah. Right? And so seeing the kind of people working on the kind of ideas with the teams they were, I mean, it honestly felt like a no-brainer, right? Expanding this, working with this ecosystem, the more time I spend in it, the more time Jay spent in it, more and more we know this will define at least a certain part of India's economy. And so I think when you talk about specific examples, I think we've been very honored to, you know, we were very early in Karza's journey. And if you say, hey, why did we invest with, you know, the founding team, which we actually invested pre-product? The truth is because they were amazing. You know, they had their domain experience. They were, you know, had incredible, I mean, they had incredible chemistry in the team when we first met them. You could tell the moment you did. But they also then executed on their vision, right? Which you can only tell once you're in, right? That early. But it was like that you know, so Karza, of course, as you know now, we exited the business. I think all the investors did. The founders are have moved to a bigger house, which is Perfios, right? As you know. But for us, that was one example of something that we played a deep role in as investors, as partners, and in fact, as friends. We are, I think, first and foremost, very good friends with everybody on that team. That was very, very big for us when we, actually, yeah. I think it's interesting, when we put Riverwalk, the thought process together, at the time the Perfios deal wasn't completely closed and stuff, we actually at Karza as one of the companies that we love to continue being part of, probably till the end of the journey, and right. Something that we voiced to the founders many times, right? You know, but of course that was, you know, they found an incredible outcome for themselves. But I think like that, of course, we've, you know, been part of SpotDraft very early, the Ayurveda experience, you know, in Home Capital, the family we invest in, Wellness Forever. So we've seen journeys of great companies in different domains. And I think then the strategy formed itself, right? So I think, you know, from an anecdote perspective, what's very clear is that the founders that have been the best at what they do were the ones that identified spaces they knew very well, but were also always thinking whether the problem they were solving was a real-time problem, right? So if you look at some of the early conversations we've had with some of the companies mentioned, they pivoted, but they're still in spaces they know very well, right? And I think that's just been remarkable.
Yeah, correct. And just to add to that, right, the 100 or so investments that we did, right? I mean, they were sort of like an accelerated MBA, right? All squeezed into like a very compressed timeline. Right. And I mean, that was our way to get like the 10,000 hours, right, that we wanted to get under our belt. And obviously things, there were some things that, you know, worked out, things that didn't work out, right? But all of it kind of like, you know, added on to like our learning, right? And the journey that we've gone through, right? So the muscle memory, the investment muscle basically built in, right? And through the course, we actually realized what we were good at, right? And what sort of we weren't good at. Right. And it was kind of like an illuminating process where, you know, we were really able to figure out that, hey, you know, these are our strengths and let's just leverage and over index on our strengths and build something around that. Right. So that process really sort of, you know, helped us understand both like who we were as like people and investors and what our strengths were.
Can we double click on that? Like, what are some of the evident strengths that get what highlighted from a thesis point of view? Because there's a lot of chatter around, okay, funds need to maintain focus.
So yes.
You have greater visibility and just depth. So the founders are, you are the port of call for founders in that particular space.
Right.
If that start emerging, what was that like from a thesis standpoint when it comes to investing?
Yeah. So, you know, from a differentiation standpoint, right, I think I personally really believe that, I mean, you don't need to stand out just for the sake of standing out, right? And just for the sake of differentiation, right? When India goes from, you know, whatever, to $10 trillion sort of in GDP, right? A lot of the value disproportionately is going to accrue to tech, right? And the mainstream sectors, if you talk about like B2B SaaS, FinTech, you know, marketplaces, consumer, etc., right? I mean, most of the value creation is going to happen through this, right? Even if you look at sort of financial services today, right, it's like 40% in the index, in the Nifty 50 as well, right? So, I mean, what we firmly believe is that if you look at how you basically have edge in this business, right? It basically comes through three forms, right? You have analytical edge, an informational edge, or a behavioral edge, right? Now, analytical edge, I would say that, hey, I mean, it's not something which is sustainably going to be different, right? If you put two smart people together with a sort of a you know, similar problem statement and put them in two other rooms, maybe they come up with the same sort of analysis, right? But what they need for that analysis is the right information, right? Which is missing here. So if I compare the public and the private markets today, public markets has an information overload, right? I mean, try to sort of get a sense that, hey, most of the things are priced in, right? If not today, they'll get priced in fairly sort of easily and quickly, right? But that's not true in the private markets, right? So a lot of the time, our focus is on trying to get diverse pieces of information from a wide enough sample size as possible, right? And then the third edge that I talk about is the behavioral edge, right? Which is basically, what can we do differently, right? And as I said earlier as well, right, is basically, hey, you know, how can sort of we play to our strengths, right? So we're not very rigid in our thought process and said that, hey, you know, if we have a sort of a top-down thesis, then, you know, that's how the world should look like, right? There should be just, you know, rainbows and sunshine, right? That's not sort of how we look at it, right? So the ability to really be long-term, right? And to be involved and still sort of stay involved with companies that we've partnered with, without a timeline that accelerates our exit, right, is a key behavioral advantage that we're using, right, that we're putting to our use. The other thing is, you know, we're in a operating in a space which is completely very dynamic, right? It keeps changing, right? I mean, the Fed does something, and then again, like, the whole world tries to figure out, hey, what do we do next, right? And similarly, there are just tons of sort of macro things that are, you know, given for us, right, and are sort of present in the setup that is available for us, right? So being able to be nimble and agile and flexible, right, and change based on the macro setup, right, I think that's something that, you know, we're blessed to have that flexibility, right, given the sort of supportive LP base that we have, right? So, I mean, that's something that we're using to our, like, behavioral advantage. That's what I would say.
Got it. Well, love that framework. I think that perfectly crystallizes what you mentioned. I love to just double click very quickly on that second point, right? The information asymmetry. I don't know how many people actually understand how private markets are evidently different from public markets, right? So if you can just double click on how this information asymmetry plays out when it comes to especially early stages, and also how do you build a competitive advantage there, right? Like, how do you get to things early? And it also looks like as India matures as a, you know, market, this will start to marginally decrease. It's already started to happen. So how do you continuously compound on this, which becomes an advantage for the future, is going to be crucial. So would love to hear you.
Yeah, the beauty is definitely in the margins, right? I mean, Sid, we took an example of sort of just a competitive athletic event or a race, right? I mean, you win by margins, right? So I think private investing, especially on the early, at the earliest stages in this country, the marquee feature of that is access, right? This is an access class,
100%.
Right? And I mean, information is something that is sort of leading to that access, right? So being plugged into the ecosystem, right? And having those relationships across, you know, great angels, great founders, great funds, results in and contributes to that sort of access, right? And that informational edge. So, a lot of folks talk about having a prepared mind, right? So when we're looking at a deal, right, that comes into our inbox, right, we try to see that, hey, even before we do the first call with the founder, right, how much can we figure out about the business already, right? And there have been times when, you know, we have a thesis that's locked down, that's kind of both built top down and bottom up, and, you know, we can pitch for the founder as well on the first call. Right. So I think the marquee feature for private investing in India is this sort of asset class being purely driven on access.
Right.
Now, after you've, let's say, you know, gained access, right, the second part comes, which is basically the evaluation part, right? Now, what sort of sources or pools of information can you tap in to really be exhaustive and have complete depth, right? To be able to say that, hey, I'm not missing out on anything. Right. And I mean, again, you want to ideally believe that you don't miss out on anything, but I'm sure you would, right? I mean, anyone does, right? So I think, again, from the evaluation perspective as well, right, it becomes very important to have the right sort of sources of information. Versus public markets, again, that's the beauty about it, right? You can sort of still sort of compound your capital and make that sort of between the 13 to 15% sort of annually. And, you know, you don't need to be out in the market to sort of source deals and sort of get that access, right? You just open your Zerodha or whatever and then just get access to whatever shares that you want to buy. So I think that's the key sort of, you know, differentiator. Yeah.
No, that's super commendable, very well explained. And what's all the more awesome is that you build this purely by word of mouth, right? Like there's not a lot of noise, you as mentioned, right? There's like to stay under the radar, yes, but still have like incredible access when it comes to early stage, and that has compounded over the years. So very, very glad to hear that there are different ways of approaching it. It's not all noise, it's not all, you know,
right,
marketing, it's not all branding. It can be done in very different ways, and the emphasis on people is very clear. What I'd love to now maybe, you know, run the tracks to is, considering that you've had, let's say, you know, traditional business exposure,
right,
lens at scale,
yes,
how has that shaped your mindset when it comes to tech investing, right? Because it looks like there are some fundamental differences when it comes to tech-first businesses versus traditional businesses, because you want to hyper-sale, you want to grow, margins may not be as much, and you prioritize different things until you get to a point where you are large enough, and then you start behaving like those other companies.
Right.
Talk to us about some of these differences, right,
right,
that you have personally observed,
right,
and then how has your mindset perhaps evolved when it comes to tech investing?
Right. Yeah, I do agree. I think that if you were to look at it from a certain lens, you could say, hey, these look in some sense conflicting, right? Traditional businesses very often, you know, focus on free cash flows and profits and, you know, and then you build your plan for CapEx and growth. And that's probably why there has been a space for so many startups to do well, right? Because then you leave a lot of white spaces behind. Mm-hmm. I think at core, whether family run or professionally managed businesses, and we've seen a lot of them, traditional businesses, actually their core role is to protect wealth and to grow it at a pace that doesn't risk, right? And so I think, you know, if you were to ask a KPI of a traditional, I would say sizable or even a mid-sized business, very often it's, you know, get through the year, make some money, be around next year, you know, by and large. That continues, and at some point, that's why they're called traditional businesses. And the interesting thing is, if you looked back, let's say on the Forbes list of 100 years ago, very few families would still be on a Forbes list today. And one of the reasons is, in a traditional business, you very often get blindsided by what you don't see. So that's, I mean, just broadly, right? I think the startup or tech-led businesses or tech-first businesses, that's probably the opposite reason of why so many of them don't succeed. Because it's almost you go hard or you go home, right? And if you go home, very often you just go hard again, right? Which is probably a good nightclub routine also. But you know, but in that sense, it's what are you building for? And so I think, you know, it's the outcome is very often how much will you risk for the reward? So I think that's very important before we get into this, right? And once you understand what's at stake for a tech entrepreneur or someone who's already at a traditional business, is you sort of understand why the mindset difference, right? In some sense, you already know as a traditional business, what is given to you, what do you have to keep? As a tech, you know, founder, very often you say, well, I want to multiply at possibly then at any cost, which then may lead into the DNA of a startup, right? One of the things that Jay and I often look for when we speak to people and founders, and you're a founder, is what are you really motivated by? And if the answer is money, it's a very high chance that your startup may not turn out the way you want. And it's very interesting because we, you know, I spoke about some of our portfolio earlier. I think if you looked at all of Riverwalk's investments, our founders, and this may sound cliche, but they're committed to solving problems. And how do you see that, right? How do you test that? And before I get into deep into the first question, but for me, a big thing, and we discussed this, right? How obsessed are you about valuation? It's not that, oh, you know, I got to reach a $100 million valuation, I got to reach a unicorn, or this is my path to, because if you speak to someone, he says, well, you know, these five rounds, or she says, these five rounds get me to $1 billion. That's probably
a bad sign. It may work out, but that's probably a bad sign of how you're approaching to solving a problem, right? So I think, you know, so that, just want to separate how I look at that. And it comes to risk, really. What are you willing to risk, right? I think the lens that we try to apply is that there is actually a lot of similarities in all businesses, right? In the sense that what you're doing should be the best use of your capital, right? So whether you're a tech startup, whether you're traditional businesses, at least to the best of our abilities, including us, including you, we're all trying to work and do the best with the resources we have, right? And so I think where that starts to converge is, where can we learn from both to make what we like, right? I think we've seen incredible examples of large businesses get built where there's some sort of a hybrid to that. I think putting a layer of technology on top of a business in a traditional ecosystem is exactly what we try to do, right? So we know the sector. So, well, this is there's a white space here that may have got missed. Yeah. Someone understands that ecosystem, but technology should lead it. I think that's actually our universe. We're trying to, you know, if you build a Venn diagram, that little circle, so that's what we're trying to do. That literally defines us, right? We have the traditional business background. We have the ecosystem, beyond our imagination what the India tech ecosystem has become. And, you know, we're a very small part of that. And so I think if I look at it through my lens, someone who comes from a generational family business, I think the similarities to take away are that whether you build a large traditional business or whether you build a tech startup that's very large, it's something that you have to do all the time, every day, right? I think that then sort of makes a traditional business cover their own white spaces and scale past their own problems, and makes a tech startup get past what they have to do to get scale. Because if you keep going at a problem every day, you will find the solution. Very likely give yourself the best chance to. I think when we talk about traditional businesses, and I still work in the family businesses, apart from Riverwalk, right?
Yeah.
And what we are starting to see is that every traditional business, if not enamored, is deeply already investing in technology. And this was led by the startup ecosystem of India,
yeah.
Right? So every conversation today may not be about AI, right? Or even if it's about AI, it may not be a practical use of AI, for example. But it's very clearly about software. It's definitely being discussed. And I think COVID really accelerated that. I mean, it's incredible. And Jen, you know, knows my father very well. And, you know, through COVID, right after COVID, I heard him asking someone on the phone. He said, well, why can't I sign this digitally? And that, incredible, right? For a man who's nearly 70 years old, who's built an incredible business career over 50 years, suddenly be like, well, why am I signing this? And I think we're seeing this across. So traditional businesses are moving very fast. And this, by the way, is something that the startup ecosystem should be watchful of. I think there is a comfort, and maybe a deep-rooted comfort in the startup ecosystem, that traditional businesses are very far away. I don't think that's true at all. I think everybody now has woken up to the fact that there is this whole revolution out there, whether they're approaching it the way Jay and Ike are doing it, saying, let's invest in it, or whether they're trying to do it themselves. So what you're seeing in some of the large companies in India, I think that that's going to be, it's a lot closer together now.
Mm.
I think there will be this, in fact, this decade, when we mapped out what Riverwalk should be, what our portfolio may choose to be, one of the things that we believe is that you will see a lot of large Indian corporates, family run or otherwise, start investing in, or working with, startups. And I think ITC investing in Mylo, one of our portfolio companies in the mother and child space, is a remarkable example.
Right? Yeah.
Investing in it, growing it, spending time with it, helping, you know, we need the founder with it. You're starting to see it. And when that happens, I think you'll have holistic businesses where the best of both worlds will come together. And I mean, hopefully Riverwalk will be investing in those businesses, but. I mean, I don't know if that's helpful, but that's the way I think about it.
Super comprehensive. I'd love to move from you, Jay. When we extend this conflict to, you know, let's say the public markets, right?
Yeah.
We've seen, you know, the new age companies like an Anchor Policy, the Daz and Motto, all go public.
Correct.
But the masses, the Indian mass, not being very accepting or rather understanding of how these businesses are still maybe earning a lot of cash, they're not as profitable, and things like that. When do you think, as a country, do we need peace with, you know, this horizontal track of startups trying to achieve profitability and becoming like old age businesses, and the older businesses becoming like startups and having that DNA? When do you think we reach that point? What do you think the mass India also needs to realize?
Yeah, I think the gap is already like narrowing.
right? And I think once, let's say you've gone public, right? I think hiding under the veil or the garb of being a startup isn't an excuse that any company should leverage, right? You're a company, you're owned by the public, right? You should, again, hold the highest standards when it comes to corporate governance and should be building towards whatever your problem statement is, right? So if you look at even like the companies that went public, the startups that went public, right? Over the last 5 or 6 months or so, they've seen quite a rally, right? And I think it's been on account of them delivering on the growth metrics sustainably, right? Without burning too much money, right? My sense is that the public market today, at least the masses, right? That's kind of like investing in the public markets is, again, has a very large option pool, right? To select from, right? And companies that are more consumer oriented, right? Which people are able to touch and feel, they have a natural affinity towards, right? Especially the younger generation, right? But again, even from a acceptance standpoint, time and time again, without naming the companies, you'll realize that if there's a big blow up, right, due to a corporate governance lap or anything, right, and a share price or any share price tanks, you suddenly see the retail participation go up. Yeah. It's actually counterintuitive, yeah, right? Because the retail is there to make money, right? So if the underlying stock, if they feel they can make money on it, right, then why will not any investor want to invest and want to participate? Right, and case in point was the IdeaForge IPO, right? It was oversubscribed by almost 90 plus times and again got a decent pop while listing as well, right? So I think, you know, we're not as, I would say, you know, far off right, from the West when it comes to acceptance.
Absolutely, no, I agree. I think public markets just reward discipline, reward predictability, and they reward good business fundamentals, which I think at some point Indian startups are also trying to appreciate.
Yes.
That is the flavor of the season.
Right.
And it's interesting how, you know, you've always followed that basic principle when it comes to investing. So that's a bit refreshing to know. I'd love to also maybe take a step back and understand that, you know, a large part of investing, and you were discussing this before we started, is, let's say, almost predicting the future, what
right,
the world looks like, what
right,
India looks like.
Right.
But now that you have seen maybe a decade of how Indian business cycles in tech have also evolved, right? From funding being a slump back in 2012, 2013, to the Flipkart news happening,
right,
that being a great exit, multiple other cycles happening, right? 16, 18 were great years because, you know, startups are coming
right
up, but then there was again a slump. Then 21 was the best year Indians have had as a startup ecosystem, but then 22, 23 is what we're seeing right now. Talk to us about A, how has this evolved in your mind?
Right.
And also maybe if we take, let's say, a forward-looking view of what India looks like,
right,
what would that be?
Right. Well, I think the maybe three things to me that converged very nicely. I think the first, and I know I've said this before, but this is to me very important, was the predictability and execution that the Indian government has provided on technology. I think it's, and of course, partners to them with iSpirit, with tons of organizations, lots of entrepreneurs. So it's not solely, of course, just the government, but the government-led initiatives that were backed by, I mean, so much of this by leaders of the ecosystem. I think that really, in this last decade, has shown that where India puts its mind to, it's unparalleled execution. UPI, of course, being discussed globally now, was 40-something percent of world's, I think 46, if I'm not wrong, of the world's digital payment transactions, right? And now being exported. So I think that was incredibly large. I think two, if you talk about the Jio effect or what the telco effect, right? Of course, Jio led a lot of that. Giving data at the cost, speed, I mean, cheapest, one of the cheapest countries in the world, one of the most largest consumption, propelled India forward in the decade behind. We, of course, didn't know what would be the catalyst, right?
Yeah.
We couldn't predict either the government nor, you know, the telco rally, but it gave internet to hundreds of millions of Indians. I think the statistic today is over 400 million Indians have access to internet fast, and they're mobile, right? Forget, you know, it in some larger fashion. And I think the third and the most important, we discussed the people in the ecosystem. And so, you know, 10 years ago when we sort of wanted to
If we had written an ideal melting pot, this would have been it. We would have, this is what we would have dreamt for, right? And I think when you look now to the next decade, one, I think the world is realized that there is no world without India, right? From an economic standpoint. There is no conversation today that I am in globally that India is not just being discussed, but now it's being focused on. You take any large fund, you take any large business, there is an India strategy. This was not the case 10 years ago. I mean, it was at that time, it was when we have an India strategy. Today is why don't we have an India strategy, right? Yeah. And as a someone, you know, comes from a family business, even inside my family, this, you know, the conversation's a lot now about India's progression and growth. I think that's big. I think that gives us the structure or at least the framework of what this decade's going to be, right? I think it's India's decade, which I'm very sure. I think the second thing is all the infrastructure that's been put in place in India, whether physical, whether the roads, whether the, you know, the connectivity with the airports, of course, the digital infrastructure. I think a lot of that kicks in this decade. This is the decade that it gets used. And so from a framework, from a stability perspective, India is looking amazing. I think when you talk specifically about what this decade may hold for the tech ecosystem, I think it's how do we continue to build on top or build alongside in some cases for the world. I think our predictions are this is the decade that India builds for the world. I think you will have Indian software used in companies in every country. I think it's no more. I think today is not even a conversation. You know, any company in the world is going to use Indian software. What and how, we don't know, right? I think you will see Indian manufacturing being led by the tech ecosystem. I think we've looked at a couple of startups recently. And it's interesting how quickly and how incredible the Indian startup ecosystem is, right? I think as the trends kick in, you have tons of great companies formed. Which ones will stick, which ones will sustain, of course, that's yet to be seen. But as early stage funds, we already see that change. And, you know, going back to an earlier point, something actually I thought maybe I wanted to cover. You talk about traditional businesses. I think the startups that we're talking to today are actually building with cash flows in mind. I think when there was a lot of liquidity, everybody was allowed to skip that part for a little bit, right? Even the traditional businesses, I think that's changed now. So I think, you know, when we look at it, this ecosystem will be led by the continued work done the decade before. And I think some of these things going forward. So I think it's very bright, actually.
Okay, yeah. I'll just add to that, right? If you just zoom out, right, and not look at like independent data points or, you know, specific cycles or a couple of years, right, within the last 10, 15 year horizon, just zoom out, right? Plot data points on a graph and measure it using any parameter of growth you want, right? Whether GDP growth, whether amount of money that was pumped in into sort of the capital markets, whether, you know, valuations, you will see a line which is upwards towards the right, yes. Right? And zooming out, the underlying factor that is contributing to this is the economic growth, yes. Right? Is the economic engine that India has running for itself and will continue.
Yes.
So that makes us extremely bullish. And that's why we're in this country, yeah. We're investing and, you know, there's no place we'd rather be.
And I think just to expand on that, one of the things that we have to be cautious of as investors is how we look at India. Do you look at it as one country? Do you look at it as multiple countries? Obviously not multiple countries, but you look at it conceptually, right? I think that's something we keep coming back and forth through. What is the value of 1 rupee to every Indian? We ask ourselves this very often, by the way. What does that mean? Right? It's very different in a city like Delhi to possibly somewhere, you know, 3 hours out, right? And I think that's very important. So when we define India and we talk about the India that's coming, it's going to be interesting because you will have categories that will have very large population bases. Then you have categories that still may have smaller population bases. But those smaller population bases could still be 100 million people, right? And so interesting how, you know, we think for the first time, even if you build a startup in India, I talk about India building for the world, you really don't have to. I think we're going to get to a point where you can build billion-dollar companies by building for a city.
Yeah.
I believe that. I believe you could build a billion-dollar company sitting here in Delhi, yeah. But just catering to something in Delhi. That's what's going to be very interesting.
Absolutely.
So when we map out, Indians are going to get wealthier. Yeah. So that's an exciting place to be. We're not going to be anywhere else.
Exactly. I mean, that was a question in my head also, right? Like we spoke about certain macro factors.
Right.
The other bit, which is very important, is that the disparity in India is also very real.
Yeah.
Like the solutions which get built for us, the first 100 or the top 100 people in the country may not be very applicable for the next set of 400 million and let alone the rest,
yes.
of the 800, 900 million population, which will come on the internet for the first time,
yes.
this upcoming decade, right?
Yes.
When we look at some of these new age solutions, right? And then we look at venture as an asset class. When building for a population that may not care as much about curation, selection, luxury as much, but yet wants new age solutions, what do you think that looks like, right? Like, I don't want to put you on the spot and be like, okay, what does the future of this India look like?
But
if you had to broadly think, what do you think solutions catered to this part of India
But sorry, maybe so
400 million Indians, which are coming from the first like top tier cities in the
running.
What do you build for them?
So, I think. Okay, that's a great question. Actually, I think you build aspirational but affordable consumption net. Like that category would be affordable but aspirational, right? And I think that has to be fueled by credit. I think there's a certain amount of India's next decade that will be fueled by the access to credit. And I think as the 400 million Indians, maybe, let's take that, get disposable income that slightly increases because of some asset access to credit. And of course, there's other countries' roads that you could map and learn, and we can learn from to see where that might go. I think people do spend a disproportionate amount on aesthetics. This is very interesting, but you know, on beauty, right? Yeah. I think there's going to be a disproportionate amount on travel. Yeah. I think this generation, especially the younger one, the younger ones that are coming into sort of the workforce will spend a lot of money on travel. Could be domestic, could be. And I think, and I expand that. I say travel and experiences. And so that's why it has to be affordable and aspirational. And I think because of social media, the aspirational part is key, because if you're spending money, you want other people to know about it. And I think we all fit in that category, right? Yeah. I think that's the mindset shift that may not have been around 15, 20 years ago. Right?
Okay.
You know, and I think that's, so I think you will see thousands of brands being built in India, Indian brands for the world, Indian brands for India. And I think you will see, and the reason I go right to credit is because that's a big part of our thesis. I think that's going to be the fueling power to get, you know, to move the economy forward.
Yeah. And again, I mean, if you look at it, right, Indian middle class, right, or India too, however you want to slice it and dice it, was always aspirational, right? With social media, that's just aspiration that's now on steroids, right? Because we have access as a country to whatever's happening globally, right? So how can we give the maximum value, the maximum bang for that buck, right? That's going to be the underlying sort of lever behind any successful business that is going to target to sort of middle India.
Right. And I think the reason we talk so much about what the macro looks like is because when we did our analysis, wherever we were able to pick great companies in great sectors, so obviously when you say it, but it's very hard to do, the outcome was phenomenal. I mean, Karza is a great example of that, to go back, right? And so I think we found an incredible statistic. I think we've not lost money basically all our investments in fintech have been effectively profitable or very profitable, right? And I think that was a decade of it. I mean, and of course, that's a broad category. And of course, it was the founders who built it. It was in the ecosystem. But so being, you know, sitting here trying to predict how we fulfill those, you know, small part of the demand. So it's where we have to think.
Absolutely, I'm sure, because I mean, as a young investor myself, the main question that I'm also trying to answer is, how do you build solutions for this part of the country, right? Like, what are the next set of solutions?
But you are like? But you are building a solution, isn't this is a solution?
Exactly. So this is a manifestation of knowledge and insights should not be only centered around a particular ecosystem.
Correct.
And should be you know, accessible for everyone.
And I think you've made it accessible, right? Which is incredible. I think that's the great thing. There you can build the business you want in India.
Sure. No, thank you so much. I think that really helps. We'll try to, you know, condense the last couple of questions very quickly. But before we get there, I have one final piece on the fund aspect. It looks like we covered a bunch of things, but the thing that is on my mind is when you go up to depth, yet you want to build, you know, access across sectors and you still have to do research, it seems like a very tough challenge from the outside, right? Because there are so many things to do. You want to put people, your founders that you're working with.
Correct.
You want to win the deals that you are on. You want to follow a forward-looking thesis. And you want to do these other things. How do we internally as a fund look at, I don't want to think of it as time management, but just like prioritization, right? Like what are P1s for you and how do you then distribute work will be an interesting problem statement.
Yeah, I think we work hard, right? And we try to do, you know, tick all the boxes, right? Because as a culture, the focus is on excellence, right? And punching above our weight, right? These are two key levers that are very, very important to us, right? So where, I mean, in the hustle, we're essentially trying to do all the things that you mentioned, right? And trying to do them sort of well enough, right? So from a prioritization standpoint, right? There are, I would say peaks and troughs, right? When, where, let's say, investing and actively deploying, right? A lot of the focus, a lot of the time spent on the team front is on sourcing.
Yes.
Right, because as I was sort of alluding to earlier, right, this is an access class, right? So having great coverage is something which is paramount, right? It's a non-starter if you don't have great coverage, right? Because if you don't see a deal, you can't invest in that deal, right? So that's the key metric, right? That, hey, how can we make sure that if there are 10 deals that are happening in the market, we see 8 or 9 out of those 10 deals, right? It could be that we're late to them, right? But we still sort of need to see those deals. Right, so a lot of time is spent on solving for the sourcing side of it, right? In the sort of deployment time frame, right? And then again, we have smaller sort of SWAT teams that we assign to a particular deal, depending on who's the right fit for that particular sector, right? And just working together with the founder, and so the evaluation side of things is like a joint exercise where you're trying to figure out the intellectual honesty and truth about any given business, right? And as a founder who's on the other side, what do you want? You want clarity, transparency, and maybe like a check post now and then to say, hey, where are you as a fund in your evaluation, right? So what we've realized is working closely with them and telling them that, hey, this is what we think, right? These are areas where we would want to build comfort. Can you help us sort of build comfort and accelerate that journey of building comfort, right? And we found most founders are absolutely okay with this sort of approach, right? They actually appreciate it a lot, right? So we try to use all these aspects to really get that coverage, right? Get that depth, right? And not compromise on our internal quality, right? Because the bar for us is extremely high, right? And we do follow a co-investment strategy, but I don't think we get influenced by any other fund's evaluation process. Right, we run it independently because that's what gets us a great night's sleep, honestly. We're trying to solve for that, right? That, hey, what can we be absolutely comfortable underwriting? And if we miss deals because of this, then so be it, right? Because missing deals is occupational hazard, right, for the space we're in.
Very interesting notes to end on. Thank you so much for being on the show. I think this has been such a pleasure for me also. A lot of very evolved frameworks when it comes to investing, when it comes to thinking about people, when it comes to just thinking about India as well. And congratulations on the 25 million fund. I think it's going to be very, very interesting. And I'm glad that we could do this. Three Sardars on the show.
Yeah.
This is something that my parents are going to be super proud of. And I'm sure this is going to serve as a very insightful conversation for many young investors, founders, and operators in the ecosystem. Thank you so much.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thank you.
Glad we could do this. Yeah.
Yes.
I'm really glad we could do this too.
Yes.
Hey, thanks.